Every child is a moral philosopher when they say it's not fair. You know, children are very concerned about justice. It's not some sort of abstract concept, it's very real. And so are we as adults. There is no stronger emotion, I think, than the thirst for justice, the expectation of justice, that justice should be done. Think of the way families sometimes spend lifetimes seeking justice. Think of those involved in the Hillborough disaster, things like the Bloody Sunday shootings. Or think of the efforts at the moment in seeking to document the war crimes in Ukraine. But it's not just in these sort of massive wars and disasters. It's part of everyday life. Think of songs. Think of rap music. Think of plays and art. So often the message in these things is a message about justice. Maybe it's about racial justice. Maybe economic justice. Why is there such a gap between rich and poor? Or if you were to go around Gravesend today, what are people talking about? Well, one of the things people talk about is the way they've been treated unfairly. They're saying this isn't right. They're looking for justice. And I was just watching the news earlier this week thinking, you cannot watch the news without being bothered about justice. How can we not be concerned about justice when you just hear just the different news items that are coming up? But my question this morning is, does it bother us? Particularly in the first instance, asking those who are Christians here today. Does the exploitation of people, the treatment of the poor, ethnic minorities, refugees, whatever you want to say, bother us? Why do we have Christian organizations that are about protecting Christian freedom, that campaign on education and marriage, and rightly do those things? But do we invest similarly in addressing things like the poverty and injustice in our society? Or to put it bluntly, do we not do that? Because those issues actually don't affect many in the church, whose lives are basically pretty comfortable. Because of the makeup, I'm talking about the church generally here, the makeup of the church, by and large, in Britain, is largely more affluent. Is it basically self-interest? We're not actually that bothered in this because it doesn't concern us. Do we say, well, we don't do all this politics stuff, all this woke stuff? Well, if we think like that, we are out of tune with Christians of the past, and more importantly, we're out of tune with God. I've said before, I'm open to massive misunderstanding here this morning. God is not woke, if you like, but he is very concerned with issues of social justice, as we shall see. But maybe you're listening to this, you're not a Christian. Maybe you're someone rather skeptical. And maybe you're listening, but nevertheless, listening as someone who is very concerned with these issues of social justice. You could almost be called a sort of social justice warrior. Well, my challenge to you this morning is, if you are really concerned with justice, if you really want justice, then you need to trust and follow the God of justice who is speaking here in Amos. Contrary to the narrative we have in our society, God is not the oppressor. In fact, the root cause of injustice in Amos's time and every age and today, the root cause of injustice is getting God wrong, not knowing him. Or to put it a different way around, how you treat people, the weakest, the most vulnerable, shows who you worship. So where there are churches, church leaders that abuse people, whatever they profess they believe, whatever experiences they say they've had, if they treat people like that, they don't know this God. Just like the leaders that Amos is speaking to in this passage that we've read. Now, I don't know what you thought as we read through Amos chapter 5. Did it seem a little confusing? A lot seems to be sort of jumbled together. Well, it's actually very clever. Remember, Amos is this master communicator. This is one of the things that's really hit me looking at Amos. He's a master communicator. This is beautifully structured. And this is the sort of pattern that we have here. Exactly the same pattern as we have in the kids' book, The Gruffalo, by the way. It's a sort of mirror image, okay, from one side to the other. So one half of the chapter is a mirror image of the other, and in the very center of this chapter, we have this hymn of praise to God in verses 8 and 9. And at the very center of that, we have this phrase, "The Lord is his name." And this is so important, because ultimately, this chapter is not about justice. It's not about justice in some sort of abstract sense. Ultimately, this chapter is about God. He's there in every verse. So if you like, the short summary of the message is if you want justice, you need this God. So let's see how that works out. First of all, God does justice. Verse 8, the Lord is his name. This word Lord is God's name, and that means his character, what he's like. And what God is like is seen in what he does, in what he values. And he is a God who is just. The very nation of Israel, where did it come from? Well, it came from God rescuing them from slavery in Egypt. From slavery, from oppression. And as they begin their new life as a nation, many of the laws that God gives to them were about care for the poor, the widow, the foreigner, the weak, making sure they had access to justice. So justice is not some sort of, don't sort of think legal theory when I use this word justice. It's incredibly practical. It's how you treat the poor. That's what God means by justice. How he expected the leaders, the rulers, to be just and fair and not to be corrupt, not to serve themselves. For example, you get it in Isaiah here. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights. It's interesting, rights language. Withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. So often, as we've mentioned, we find this combination together of justice and righteousness. We find it here in verse 7 in Amos. This is what God requires of his people, to deal with what is wrong and to do what is right. That the two terms are almost the same. Why does God require that? Is it just some sort of arbitrary rule? He requires it because it reflects his own character. This is what God cares about. God is just and righteous. Think of those verses we read at the start of the service. And so in verse 14, when God says, seek good, verse 15, seek justice or maintain justice, seeking good, maintaining justice is the same as seeking God. To seek justice is to seek God. Social justice, if you like, is theology. It's about God's character. And God is just in this way as well. God is utterly fair. Right at the end of the chapter, he says, I will pass through your midst. That is meant to echo the very thing that delivered them from Egypt. When God passed through Egypt, the firstborn were slain. That's how Israelites were rescued. But God is saying, now I'm going to do this to my own people. If you like, God is perfectly fair. There's no favoritism. So he is just, and he brings judgment. You see, God's commitment to justice is not sort of virtue signaling. He's not all saying how much I care. He's not wearing the right T-shirt, aligning himself often at no cost with the right cause. God actually intervenes. He brings justice. He does stand up for the poor. He does judge the oppressor. Verse 11. This is justice for you, isn't it? Therefore, though you have built stone mansions, these sort of ivory houses he's spoken about before, you will not live in them. Though you have planted lush vineyards, you will not drink their wine. You see, those you've got rich through this corruption, well, you're going to lose those riches. That's justice. And when you see that, that this hymn of praise at the center of the chapter is not some sort of strange thing out of place. When it talks about the God who made the Pleiades and Orion, these constellations, they're associated with the winter and the summer, with the seasons. It's saying that God is the one who controls the order of creation. He controls the seasons. He controls the day and the night, the rain and the floods. So the God that controls creation in that way is the God who is able to bring moral order, to bring justice, even to those who live in those strongholds, in those fortified cities, who think they're totally safe and God can't touch them. Of course he can. He's the creator of everything. So God can bring this justice in a way that we can't. We can't control the sun and the stars. And justice is complicated, isn't it? I pity, as a parent you get it, but I mean, teachers in school, you know, those playground disputes. How on earth can you be sort of fair there? How can you know exactly what was said by who, when, and everything else? How on earth can you be fair? It's really hard, isn't it? But it's the same across history. How can you bring justice from the slave trade? You know, that's a current topic, isn't it? You know, should we have these reparations? You know, that's actually really complicated, isn't it? Well, God, the creator, sees everything, knows everything about everyone across all history. He knows all the connections, all the mitigating circumstances, all the things that lead to something else further down the line. And at the end of history, he will bring a final judgment, a perfect judgment that gets that totally right. And the judgments we read of here in Amos are just a foretaste of that final judgment. So God is a God of justice. And he, as he brings that justice, he will bring peace. The peace, the shalom peace, where everything is put right. He is going to do what no politician, no social reformer can achieve. He's the God of justice. But for now, we read here of God lamenting. Look how Amos starts this chapter. Remember I said he's the master communicator because he's speaking at a time of great prosperity. The nation has never had it so good. There's peace, there's money. The people are complacent. Life is a party. So what does Amos do? He speaks as if he's at a funeral. It's very jarring, these first three verses. It's a lament. He's speaking about the death of a nation. He's really giving an obituary to the nation as if they're already dead. You know, it's like these people that sometimes read their obituary before they've died. Fallen is virgin Israel, never to rise again. Deserted in her own land with no one to lift her up. Fallen, not to rise. That means you're buried. There's death where there should be life. Virgin Israel, it's this idea of the whole life ahead of you, and it's been cut short, and she's alone, abandoned, when there should be companionship. And the land, well, this land is meant to be a place of hope, of promise, of fertility, but it's a graveyard. What was meant to be their inheritance is now dispossessed. So it's a great reversal. In verse 3, the nation is decimated. And it was only 30 or so years later from when Amos was speaking that it actually was. The party didn't last. It wasn't centuries later. It was just decades later. That prosperity disappeared and they were taken into exile. And in verse 16 and 17, there's wailing in the streets and the squares and the vineyards. The farmers are seconded to help the professional mourners. It's a bit like saying there's so much death that the doctors are being used to help the undertakers. So what's going on here? Well, notice it's Amos that's speaking at the start of the chapter. It is God who is speaking at the end. But the way prophecy works in Scripture is that Amos's words are God's words, and God's words are Amos's words. You can't separate the two. So when Amos laments, God laments. What is lament? Well, you can find some sermons on the website about this, but just briefly, it's ordered grief. It's crying out to God, it's not meant to be like this. See that, how that's linked to justice? You know, this isn't the future that Israel was meant to have. This isn't what God wanted, if you like. And it's the same for all humanity. The sin and the deadly consequences of sin are not how it's meant to be. This isn't how God wanted things to be. This is not what God made us for in the beginning. So Amos here is grieving. And that is really quite striking, isn't it? Amos grieving, this prophet who speaks so bluntly, so bitingly about the sins of Israel. But understand, there is no delight or glee in the judgment that he announces on Israel. Christians that speak with glee over judgment do not reflect the heart of God. There is no delight in vengeance. Rather, our response should be lament. It's a bit like when you see a criminal sentenced. It is right that they receive justice. We don't apologize for that. It's something that is necessary. But it's actually a terrible thing, isn't it, that the crime has been committed? It's a terrible thing that someone who was made for something very different is going to spend their life in prison. That is actually a terrible thing. It's just, it's right, and yet it's also something to be grieved over. We are grieving over the sin and its punishment. It's not how it's meant to be. So we could sort of put it like this. With God, there's no such thing as sort of cold justice. God is not some distant judge. He's not administering a system with no emotional engagement. God rightly judges. He's not embarrassed by judgment, but he does so with a heavy heart. Ezekiel tells us God takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked. Jesus weeps over Jerusalem just days before it's the place where he is crucified. They commit the biggest crime of all history, and yet he weeps over Jerusalem and the judgment that will come upon it. And here God is lamenting over a nation that has moved so far from his heart in their treatment of the poor and in their corruption of justice. You see, this is the charge against Israel. This is what God sees. God sees, but the people are blind. Verse 14, it says, you know, then the Lord Almighty will be with you just as you say he is. They think God is with them. They think God is pleased with them. They are clueless. They don't see their own injustice. But God is very clear that he does see it in verse 12. I know how many are your offenses and how great your sins. God sees their many sins, everything, each one. God doesn't sort of get used to sin. You know, it's like in the news, when there's one scandal, it makes the news. But then when you get to the 10th one, well, it's all old hat. We're not interested anymore. God's not like that. The 10th matters as much as the first. You know, what difference does another corrupt decision make? Well, it makes an awful lot of difference to the victims. And that is who God sees here. God sees the victims. God sees the people with no voice, with no influence, with no justice. And the sins that God highlights here are not sexual sins. They're not sins of even religious idolatry. But they're respectable sins. The sins that are often hidden and often dressed up to appear okay. Sins of greed. Sins of bending the truth. Sins of corruption. Sins that reside sometimes in the heart. God sees it all. So what's actually going on here? Verse 11, you trample on the poor, you force him to give you grain. Well, you can understand, that can almost be translated as you impose heavy rents on the poor and you force them to give you taxes of grain. In other words, this isn't just sort of brazen criminality. It's all done with the pretense of legality. You can just imagine the leader saying, well, we believe in justice. You know, we just believe in an economic system. We're just getting the rent that we're owed, the tax that's due to us. We're just being fair. This is right. This is just. You know, we're doing the right thing. This is how the system works. It's perhaps not so different to President Putin claiming he's just getting the land back that belongs to him. You know, and you can imagine these leaders saying, well, if you think these rents and these taxes are unfair, you can take us to court. It's literally the gate when it talks about the court here. It was the place in the city where the elders and the leaders would administer justice. But the problem was there was no justice at the gate, at the court, because people weren't interested in the truth, verse 10. They were only interested in money, verse 12. They take bribes. The biggest bribe will win. So what is precious to God, righteousness, is cast down like rubbish. The justice that's meant to be sweet, you know, when people say, I'll get my day in court, I'll vindicate myself, it turns out in verse 7 to be a cause of bitterness. Because you get to the court and you're told, sorry, you don't qualify. You haven't given enough money. So it's not about justice, it's actually about power. The leaders are using their power to serve their own interest. And their logic is basically this: if it's in my self-interest, it must be right. Isn't that a logic that pervades our society? If it's in my self-interest, it must be right. And before you point the finger at the people of Amos's day, think of how we can all be guilty of that. We use self-interest to justify what we think is right, and we can do that whether we're rich or we're poor. There can be tax evasion, there can be benefit fraud, but there can also just be very simple greed, lack of generosity. God sees our hearts. But I think it's crucial that we see that Amos is exposing something deeper than individual personal sin. There is institutional injustice here. And I'm mystified why some Christians sort of object to this concept, because to me it's in Amos, it's throughout the Bible, and it's exactly the thing that happens when when with sin. To me, it's an illustration of some of the questions on the sheet of the depth and the breadth of sin. So what's going on here is not simply individual unjust decisions, but it's a whole system that promotes injustice. It's institutions that are corrupt. It's a situation where sin is so common, it's normalized as being acceptable. And so the classic thing here is verse 13. You know, the prudent man keeps quiet at such times. Keep quiet if you want to get on. Don't challenge the system. You know, this is how we do things here. Don't challenge it. Just think how this, you know, people collude together. That's how this systemic injustice works. everyone's in it together, protecting each other, holding up the whole system. But it's presented as if everything is okay. And so, you know, in Amos's time, everyone has access to justice. You know, we don't discriminate. If you can't pay the bribe, you won't get it. So who suffers? It's the people that can't pay. It's the poor. And you know what? Today in our country, everyone has equal access to the courts. There's no discrimination. We're all equal under the law. Really? Not if you don't have the money to pay the legal fees and the lawyers. The sort of changes to legal aid, I think, are something that should actually really bother us as Christians. It's not something that gets votes, is it? Because you get all the stories of all these criminals getting legal aid, but actually that is actually what a justice system needs, isn't it? Where everyone has access, that's the whole point, everyone has access to justice. But it works in other ways too. Employment tribunals. If you're someone maybe with learning difficulties, if you can't argue your case in the right way, if you don't understand the system, you're at a disadvantage. It favours those who are sort of have the right background. Think of what happened in America in the past. Legally speaking, everyone had the right to vote. But they then introduced barriers to registration to vote that disproportionately stopped black people from being able to register, which also actually excluded them from jury service, which meant you had courts where the jurors, you had an entirely sort of white jury. That's what went on in America in the past. And today in Britain, institutional racism can still exist. And it's something that should bother us because God hates injustice. And this injustice can take many forms. What about work practices of some employers, the way the lack of protection for workers, exploitation, low wages, again, often under a guise of legality, but the reality is people are oppressed. Or where you have organizations where their policies that are set up in the name of safety are not actually about protecting vulnerable people, they're about protecting the organization. That's actually what the rules are about. They're about protecting those with power, protecting them from liability. There's loads of ways this could be applied. Think how often you hear that phrase, it's not our policy, as a way of avoiding responsibility. And I've been really challenged on just how Christians in the past have responded to social evil. Personal morality is not enough. So think of the days when we had the slave trade. You know, you could say, well, I don't own a slave. I'm not doing any slave trading. I'm fine. But I'm not sure Amos would agree. You are part of a society that is promoting slave trading. You are buying the products that have come from slave trading. You are benefiting from the riches that come from slave trading. You are connected in some way to this. What are you doing to challenge the evil in society? Now, this begs all sorts of questions. How on earth does this apply? What should I do? We'll come next Sunday afternoon and we'll talk about it. It's not easy. But it's not something we can ignore. And God here is not making the poor some sort of special category of victim. Special treatment. There's no dignity in that. He simply wants them to be treated equally and fairly. And he's holding the rulers, the leaders, to account for the system that they preside over and that we contribute to. So what's the answer? New leaders, new political parties, new campaigns? Well, those things can play a part. But that's all been done before, and injustice is still with us. It is a problem that is too big for us. Ultimately, we are all part of the problem. We're people who pursue our own self-interest, and we are involved in it, whether we like it or not, in a society that promotes injustice. We're connected to that. We're not simply individuals. There's a collective responsibility, and we're part of it. So what's the answer? Well, it's back to God again. God is the one who promises life. In verse 4, seek me and live. Verse 14, seek good, not evil, that you may live. You know, the surprise here in a chapter focusing on justice, where sin has been so pointedly exposed, we find grace. It's incredible. God's saying, seek me and live. God's not given up on Israel, and he's not given up on you or me. And this life that he's promising is not simply existence, it's true flourishing. It's the life that we were made for. The life that we were made for with God. You know, it's something much bigger than equal opportunities, better education, better housing, more money. It's about being a new person. A person who has found this true life in God. So how is this life found? Well, it's not in some sort of outward religious observant. He says, don't go to Bethel and to Gilgal or even journey to Beersheba. You see, Bethel, Gilgal, and Beersheba were the religious shrines. Beersheba was the place where God had made promises to the sort of ancestors of the nation, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that was in the southern kingdom of Judah. So people were even traveling down there to do this. But he says, even traveling there into another land will do you no good. And I think what must be going on here is the people were treating God a bit like they treated the poor. The people thought they could do a deal with God. They could manipulate God, just like they did the courts. They could almost bribe God with their religious duty. So bribe God in that, and then he'll turn a blind eye, and they can just live as they like. But God is just. He can't be bought off or manipulated. And however much you've served God, he owes you nothing. It's not that way. Rather, you have to seek God. Seek God himself. Not even seek God's blessings, but seek God himself. And look how he puts it, seek good, not evil. Again, it's very practical. It's not about nice, fine words. Oh, yes, this is how much I love God. I don't care what you say about that. I don't care what the profession is. The test of that is what you actually do. The test of it is your life. If you seek God, you will turn away from the evil that he hates. You will seek good. That is what seeking God will mean. You can't seek God and live as you like. God is wanting a change of heart here. He says, hate evil, love good. It's not simply even what you do, it's about what you want. It's wanting what God wants. It's loving what God loves. It's loving that righteousness and justice. So following God is not this sort of spiritual bit in my life, sealed off from what I do with my family and my work. It's all of life. This is so practical. So my question is, do you really want justice? Do you want what is right in God's eyes? Or do you simply want God to approve you as you are? Do you want God to correct you? If you want justice, it means that you recognize that God should judge you for your wrong, for your sin. We're very quick to point out what's wrong with everyone else. But we must start with what is wrong in myself. If God is going to be just, he needs to judge you for your wrong, for your sin. Which means you have no right to mercy. That's what grace means. It's not deserved. And it's why I think Amos says here in verse 15 this great phrase, perhaps the Lord God Almighty will have mercy. The whole point here is that it's not deserved. There's nothing automatic about this. This is purely God's favor and grace. But that should leave us with a question, that there's a mystery here. How can God be a God of justice and not punish this sin? How can he show mercy? How on earth can that be just? It's a problem you find all the way through the Old Testament. There's never a full answer. How can God forgive people? We don't get the answer till Jesus comes and dies on the cross. Romans 3, God presented him, that's Jesus Christ, as a sacrifice of atonement. That means a payment for sin through faith in his blood. He did this to demonstrate his justice because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. It all sort of been left delayed. He did it to demonstrate his justice at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. God here can justify the guilty. He can declare them not guilty if they have faith in Jesus who dies in their place. In other words, the penalty required by justice falls on Jesus. Justice is done, and we can be put right with God. That's incredible grace and mercy. You see, the problem in Amos's time was that they didn't know this God. They thought they did, but they didn't really know what he was like. And it's the same problem today. Which is why if you want social justice, the first step is not a soup kitchen or a food bank or some handouts. It's actually to plant churches. That's actually a lot harder. To be ready to live in deprived communities. Well, every community needs it, but why disproportionately are churches not found in deprived communities? Because we don't want the cost of living there by and large. We prefer to be somewhere more pleasant, somewhere nicer for our children or whatever. This is very searching. I tell you, I've been going through this and thinking, how can I say these things? How does this apply to me? What should we be doing as a church? This is very searching. But we need to do this so that people can meet this God, so that they can know the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ. God is the agent of social justice. If you want justice, seek him.